Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Sunday through Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Who's Reading the Organon, a show co-hosted by Vera Resnick and Debbie Bruck. We're challenging you to join us on our journey to complete Samuel Hahnemann's Organon in 1 year. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Debbie Bruck, founder of Homeopathy World Community, talking with classical homeopath Vera Resnick. Today is August 22, 2010, and you're listening to show number 76 of Who's Reading the Organon. I sent out a broadcast message to the Homeopathy World Community telling them we were reading aphorism number 56. However, there is a correction. We will be reading aphorism 57 today. So open up your books and take a look at where we are. We will be started in a few minutes. First, we're going to begin with the inspirational quotes so that we get into a good frame of mind. There is one that's author unknown. It says, "A hug is a great gift. One size fits all, and it's easy to exchange." Another one, these are both quoted by Quote Garden from Twitter. "Never let success get to your head, and never let failure get to your heart." We don't want anyone feeling poorly today. And here's another one by Evan Parker. "Certain kinds of speed, flow, intensity, density of attacks, density of interaction, these are all music that concentrates on those qualities is, I think, easier achieved by free improvisation between people sharing a common attitude, a common language." So how will that relate to us in our personal sphere, in our world, and in the homeopathy world community? Somebody do a blog about it. And here's one that I sent out. Oh, I didn't send it out, but I was thinking about doing it. By David Ferrier. It says, "A computer, a million morons working at the speed of light." I just thought that was too humorous to pass up. Vera, are you with us?
Right, I'm with you.
Okay, great.
Hi, Debbie.
Good morning, everyone. I hope it's a great Sunday for you. And I have a couple of things to pay attention to on the network. One, there's some discussion going on about yoga and improving the brain and improving quality of life and just overall good health. So just Google that yoga on HWC and see what you come up with. There's also a lot of discussion about the vaccinations, what's going on in the epidemic and pandemic homeopathy category, having to do with the influenza and how they are gearing up to vaccinate literally everybody, no matter whether they know what it will do, short or long term. Take a look at that. Put it on your website. Blog about it. Tweet about it. And then there is one by Dr. Adil Chimthana. Help me there, Vera. Chimthanawala. I will have to ask him how to pronounce his name. And he has put up a fantastic blog about arteriogenesis, having to do art and the arteries and what that means for our health. And lastly, Gary Weaver is asking you to post your very best cases on HWC for a competition that he has put up to win a computer program. So we are ready to move straight into aphorism number 56, 57, unless you want to do a review of anything of where we've been to lead up to this one.
I think I'd just rather move into 57 this time.
Okay.
56 was a discussion of how allopathic medicine has persisted. as was 55. 56 footnotes also refer to Hahnemann's opposition to isopathy, to using the same substance. So now we're back to the discussion of allopathic, of how is allopathic medicine carried out, and what Hahnemann thinks of it. So shall I read, Debbie?
Yes, please.
Okay. In order to carry into practice this allopathic method, the ordinary physician gives, for a single troublesome symptom from among the many other symptoms of the disease which he passes by unheeded, a medicine concerning which it is known that it produces the exact opposite of the morbid symptom sought to be subdued, from which he can expect the speediest palliative relief. He gives large doses of opium for pains of all sorts, because this drug soon benumbs the sensibility, and administers the same remedy for diarrheas, because it speedily puts a stop to the peristaltic motion of the intestinal canal and makes it insensible, and also for sleeplessness, because opium rapidly produces a stupefied comatose sleep. He gives purgatives when the patient has suffered long from constipation and costiveness. He causes the burnt hand to be plunged into cold water, which from its low degree of temperature seems instantaneously to remove the burning pain as if by magic. He puts the patient who complains of chilliness and deficiency of vital heat into warm baths, which warm him immediately. He makes him who is suffering from prolonged debility drink wine, whereby he is instantly enlivened and refreshed. And in like manner, he employs other opposite antipathic remedial means, but he has very few besides those just mentioned, as it is only of very few substances that some peculiar primary action is known to the ordinary medical school.
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right.
Some of these this direction we're familiar with. I think there are many people who will plunge a burn into cold water.
It makes sense,
hand.
Doesn't it?
It seems
it certainly
to,
does make sense. Mm-hmm. But they don't realize the secondary effect, that in the immediacy of the moment it feels good, but it is not perhaps the best way to relieve that totality of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
If
we think also of what certainly I was told to do with my daughter, and we're talking like 14 years ago, I was told if she had a fever, I should put her in a cool bath.
Mm-hmm.
So this, I don't think we can say that anything about this aphorism is out of date.
Well, I would kind of agree. If you don't have homeopathy and you have somebody who's running a very high fever and it can be life-threatening, then to put the person into a cool bath seems to be the most logical thing to do to draw out that heat and get the temperature down as quickly as possible, because it could damage. So,
but we need to differentiate between what seems logical and what actually does not make sense. Because in the same way as if we don't have homeopathy and we do a burn, I was thinking of telling this, I think I must have mentioned this story in a previous show. One of the things that many homeopaths know, that when we're working in the kitchen and we get like these small kitchen burns or even larger kitchen burns, then in some shape or form, many of us will simply bring our hand close to the source of the heat, as close as is bearable, and hold it there for a few seconds and then bring it away. And that prevents the burn from developing. It stops the process of the burn and prevents blistering. Do you use that one, Debbie?
Yes, I do know about it, but I just keep my my gel handy in the drawer next to me, so I'd use that. I use Cantharis or something.
I use it the whole time. I use that method. And it got to the point where I was thinking, well, maybe I'm just kidding myself. Maybe I didn't really burn myself. So I deliberately did not use the method. And I got a burn and blister. And then there was a time when I spilt some hot tea over my hand. I was in somebody else's house. And I went to the kitchen looking for some source of heat. There was a pot of soup on the stove, like a steam hole. So I used that as source of heat. And from scalding tea, the skin didn't even redden. It was amazing.
Perhaps this should be part of our emergency aid learning that very few people actually know about, because I would not say that this is common knowledge. I would say most people would immediately get out a piece of ice and put it on, or put it under the running cold water and things like that.
I think you'll find I think you'll find amongst homeopaths a lot more people use this than you would think. Because at one point I started asking around to see who knew about it, who used it, and I found homeopaths, many homeopaths do use it, and many homeopaths, people who are connected to homeopaths, spouses, children, family, they discovered it, they tried it, they saw it worked, and it does work. So part of the problem, like when we say it's logical, it seems like it makes sense. And Hahnemann is taking us into the realm of the counterintuitive, which is something that we've mentioned before. You know, what give a remedy to a healthy person to see what it does? Why do we do that? It doesn't seem logical. Let's give a remedy to a sick person. And Hahnemann says no, and he says, look at it, but look at it with fresh logic. Don't look at it with used up, chewed up logic. And the same thing here. He's saying, if a person is cold, you put them into a warm bath. So what happens? You warm immediately, and then afterwards you come out, and as soon as you take off a layer, you start shivering. It's not a solid warmth. It's not an internal warmth. By the same token, if someone's hot and you put them in a cold bath, you may cool them down on the instant, but the result, the following, will be a further heating up and a confusion of the whole thermoregulatory system in the body. It doesn't know if it's hot or cold, and then it gets sick instead.
I think in Chinese logic or Chinese healing, they would normally, when it's hot, you have hot tea. Even in the South America, it's a hot, temperate zone, and they eat very hot, chili foods.
Debbie, you're talking to a Brit. I mean, hot tea on a hot day, of course.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Well, okay, so I mean, that's likes. And also, I'm considering the opposite end of the scale. I'm considering when somebody gets frostbite in the freezing cold and their skin is literally hard and it's going to crack off, you don't plunge it into hot. You very slowly move from the cold temperate zone to the warmer, and so that something is not as drastic a change to cause some harm. And the same thing, if somebody is underwater and they're having oxygen deprivation, there's a word for that, for people who do scuba diving and things, you don't go immediately up to the top or you will die. You have to slowly move from where you are to the place where you need to be. So it's an adjustment within the body. Is this anywhere?
But part of the thing also, like it was explained to me many years ago why we drink tea in England on a hot day, and why that's more refreshing than drinking cold. And the answer given was that when you drink hot on a hot day, then you start to sweat, and when you start to sweat, the sweat cools you down.
Yeah.
So preventing sweating actually is something that will heat you up.
So that's why hot peppers do that.
All linked. One point that I'd like to bring out here, though, the concept the ordinary physician gives for a single troublesome symptom from among the many other symptoms of the disease which he passes by unheeded. So first of all, Hahnemann's critique of conventional medicine is that it singles out a troublesome symptom from a group, and then treats that rather than treating a picture of symptoms, a pattern. But the second thing that Hanuman mentions is sort of in a backhanded way. He says at the end of the aphorisms, he says it's only of a very few substance that some peculiar primary action is known to the ordinary medical school. The whole issue of primary and secondary actions is a complex issue. But like, for example, with opium, why this is brought up. Opium, it numbs sensibility, it numbs sensitivity, but then can increase sensitivity. That's the secondary action. So that's why people need larger and larger doses of opium. The same in opium's reaction for diarrhea. It will stop diarrhea because it stops the activity of the intestinal canal. But then when things restart, the diarrhea will get worse. And also, as I remember, opium can do a switch from diarrhea to constipation to diarrhea to constipation.
Yes, correct, it will.
If I'm wrong there.
Yes, it will. It can cause tremendous constipation. Definitely. And then you're in a bad way. So the other thing that he's talking about here is this word palliative relief, speedy palliative relief. And just so the idea of palliation is not to cure. Palliation is just relief of symptoms, not for the goal of actually receiving cure. And this is something that homeopaths also use when they're in a place with a patient where there is not really very much hope for cure, when a person comes and they have already gone through lots and lots of treatments over many years for a very serious condition, and there's little hope because of the extent of the illness. Mm-hmm. And palliation is used. Also on the internet, on Homeopathy World Community, there are two new articles specifically about palliation having to do with cancer patients. And they found that palliation doubles the lifespan of the individual who is undergoing treatment when palliative care, which I think means a lot more than just giving a remedy, but it means total care, comfort, and complementary medicine, things like that. They double the lifespan. Yes.
The dilemma in homeopathy is that in order to go for palliative care, it means that you have stated in some shape or form that the case in front of you is incurable.
Right.
That's the only reason that you can go for palliative and accept palliative as a way to go, a way to work. At what point do we accept a case as incurable? The fact that conventional medicine says something is incurable is not usually a guideline for us as homeopaths.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is quite a major dilemma amongst homeopaths today. First of all, there's the element of we're told the case is incurable, but our job is still to take the case if they come to us. Like to take the case as any other case without the prejudice that it's incurable. Also, something being incurable for us can very often simply mean there's no way to get clear symptom picture. And without knowledge, we can't work. We're guessing in the dark. But it's a big question. Like there are some patients where I'm working and I see symptom patterns coming back and I feel that the work I'm doing is not curative, it's palliative. And then there's the question of, is that all that I can do for this patient? Is there a possibility for this patient to have cure? Now, in one case that I can think of, there have been so many operations in the past, so many procedures. I don't know whether there's something I can do that's curative. There's definitely something that I can do that's palliative. But these are dilemmas. Case discussions are very helpful in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. When there's been so much pathological change, tissue change, and serious accidents that have changed the normal functioning of the person's body, those are really tough problems. And how to approach it, I guess, study from persons, from homeopaths who have been working with these types of cases to mm-hmm. learn how they approach them. And go to someone who has the experience with that kind of thing. And there's this is kind of opened up to a big question of palliation, and maybe further on in the Organon there's more information about it. And mm-hmm. how do we integrate palliative homeopathic care into the traditional Western medicine? Do we want to be able to introduce that to them? So the use of cell salts, the use of remedies for cancer patients that we know will alleviate, let's say, grief, loss, fear, the side effects from chemotherapy and radiation. There are a lot of ways to do that. The National Health Center, the Health Service has an article on there. I've posted it on HWC about remedies that they have used in those cases. And I do want to affirm again that sometimes it can be helpful, whether it is homeopathic care or regular other kinds of care, for instance, breathing work, guided imagery, other kinds of things that help to the whole person to deal with this very possibly hopeless situation. Is there anything else with aphorism 57?
No, I think we can move on to aphorism 58, but do we have time?
Yes. Go
okay,
ahead.
Okay, would you like to read it?
Okay, let's see. So we're up to aphorism 58. If, in estimating the value of this mode of employing medicines, we should even pass over the circumstance that it is an extremely faulty symptomatic treatment, wherein the practitioner devotes his attention in a merely one-sided manner to a single symptom, consequently to only a small part of the whole, whereby relief for the totality of the disease, which is what the patient desires, cannot evidently be expected. We must, on the other hand, demand of experience if, in one single case where such an antipathic employment of medicine was made use of in a chronic or persisting affection, after the transient amelioration, there did not ensue an increased aggravation of the symptom, which was subdued at first in a palliative manner, an aggravation, indeed, of the whole disease. And every attentive observer will agree that after such short antipathic amelioration, aggravation follows in every case without exception. Although the ordinary physician is in the habit of giving his patient another explanation of the subsequent aggravation, I'm laughing, and ascribes it to malignancy of the original disease, now for the first time showing itself, or to the occurrence of quite a new disease. And it looks like there is a footnote to that. I don't know whether I have it handy. I don't have it handy, so I'll let you read that. But in aphorism number 58, he's really taking us through the process of what's to be expected when you do he's calling it a one-sided case, which you were mentioning before, with dealing with only one symptom. And sometimes homeopaths do that too, not intentionally, I'm sure, but only looking at one part and not how the whole picture comes together. And then he's saying there's no exception to this rule that after the immediate amelioration, there is an aggravation following it from giving a oppositional or antipathic remedy. Let me see.
What was making you laugh?
What was making me laugh? Where did I say it?
You said it, although the ordinary physician is in the habit of giving his patients another explanation.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's why I was laughing, because, you know, you're going to go to the doctor and they're going to give you a medication And it's usually not just one essence of one chemical or something. It's usually a combination anyway. But let's say it is one thing, and it is used as a antihistamine, antidepressant, anticoagulant, whatever it might anti-be, and there's going to be a rebound. There's going to be a response. And once that response occurs and you've overdosed the person or whatever, then the patient's going to go back and the doctor's going to say, oh, well, they're going to give you an explanation and another drug or something to that effect. So that's why I'm laughing, because that is their mode of thinking. They're not in this mode of thinking. And I think, 64 is the, it's quite a large footnote. So let me
read the footnote, because part of the footnote is in Latin. And
okay.
And
you might be better
I have
at
a
that.
Translation. No, I have a translation of the Latin here.
Okay,
so I'm reading this footnote from O'Reilly, which I don't usually use. Little as physicians have hitherto been given to observation, the certain aggravation resulting from such palliatives could not escape their notice. A striking example of this is found in J.H. Schultz's work. Willis attests to something similar, and here's translation from the Latin. Opiates generally assuage, that means alleviate, the most severe pains and bring on insensibility, meaning not loss of sense, but loss of consciousness. And they
mm-hmm.
continue the insensibility, the analgesic quality, for some time and for a fixed period. When that period has elapsed, the pains soon flare up again, and in short order increase to their accustomed severity. And also, on page 295, he's quoted from Willis again, when the opium strength is spent, the intestinal pains return straight away, nor do they slacken their severity unless they are charmed away again by the same drug, like the language. In like manner, John Hunter, move back to Berica, says that wine and cordials given to the weak increase the action without giving real strength, and powers of the body are afterwards sunk proportionally as they have been raised, by which nothing can be gained, but a great deal may be lost.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not giving theories here, Hahnemann. He's
mm-hmm.
giving observations that were actually not only his observations, but also those of others.
And everyone is completely aware of the addictive quality of opiates, which are morphines, codeines, things like that. So we do know, we're very knowledgeable about how these drugs work. And to give them for, it's actually palliative care, just
mm-hmm.
to alleviate the immediacy. I mean, who doesn't want morphine if they've been in a car accident and their body is totally broken? I mean, truly, it can.
I think you need to distinguish between use of opium in extreme emergency care and use of opium in more casual use. I mean, in the 19th century, people gave opium to their kids to keep them quiet at night.
Mm-hmm.
People gave opium. Yeah, we can mm-hmm. continue the discussion tomorrow. But,
we will definitely continue with 57 and its footnote, because it's got quite
58.
A bit to talk about. Oh,
yeah.
58.
I know.
Boy,
yeah.
I seem to be lagging behind one aphorism today.
Okay.
But hopefully we'll get back on track. This has been good.
Okay.
So to close, let's just say that we are studying about palliation, antipathic methods, how the ordinary physician uses drugs. And
mm-hmm.
we will see you tomorrow for a great discussion on who's reading the Organon. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks, Debbie.
Thank you for listening to Who's Reading the Organon? With homeopaths Vera Resnick and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio. Remember to take the Organon off the shelf and read it.